Yep. Give me a nod when you're ready. I'm like four. Jitter's ready. Stand by.
Everyone, welcome to this episode of Bullets and Bourbon. I'm Frank Gao, joined by my co-host, Matt Gunlock. Today, we have a returning guest. It's Major Parker Tomasi. He's been on a couple episodes before, still serving as the operations officer at Weapons Training Battalion Stone Bay, where he hosts intramural matches, helps coordinate for the MCMX, distinguished rifle shooter. But most recently, he attended a class. He attended a class by Travis Tomasi. For those of you that don't know Travis, he was a member of the Army Marksmanship Unit, and he currently shoots for Masterpiece Arms. So he's been around the competition scene for a very long time. I want to say he's been to some world shoots. He's pretty much done it all in his day. At this point, he's continuing to compete, teaching a lot. So Parker, You've interacted with Travis before you met him in person. How did you first find out about him, and what was that interaction like?
Yeah, so Tomasi is not a very common last name. It is apparently in Italy, where both our families are from. So in the early days of YouTube, a young Corporal Tomasi posted a video of him doing some mag changes. It's just a side profile. And that was kind of when he was introduced to the shooting world as the fastest reloader on the planet. This guy is butter every single time. So my dad found that video on YouTube. And this is like right around the time when I'm starting to get better at shooting and kind of gain some notoriety. And so I was like, oh, like, here's this guy with my same last name, and, you know, he's doing the thing. That's pretty cool, you know? So I've kind of always just kind of kept tabs on Travis from a distance, ever since then. And then the beautiful thing with the advent of social media is you can reach out to pretty much anybody. So I found Travis on Instagram, and just shot him a message. It's like, hey man, here's who I am. I'm a shooter too. We might be related. I don't know. Are you, you know, like what part of Italy is your family from? We kind of go down that path for a little bit. And him being on the AMU, and then after he retired, I think he moved to Alabama. So he's kind of stayed on the East Coast, and me being in North Carolina, it's like, hey, not too far away. So we went, bump into each other in a major match sometime. I was hoping he was going to be at the Carolina Classic this year, but he wasn't able to make it. So then last minute, I think on Wednesday afternoon, one of my Marines comes into my office and he's like, hey, have you heard of this guy, Travis Tomasi? It's like, yeah, a little bit. I've heard of him. He's like, well, he's doing a pistol performance class. Down the road, is about an hour away. I was like, shoot. So I hopped on at last minute. I sent him a message. I was like, hey, I know we've been trying to link up for some time, but we'll finally get to meet face to face this weekend. So that's kind of how that went.
Yeah, super cool. Did you guys ever, like, I guess, narrow down where in Italy your families came from? Is there any chance overlap, or is it just still hanging out there?
So we are both from the same part of Northern Italy, like kind of Bologna type area. But we haven't been able to trace it back to a person where our family trees branched. And it, like I said, it's a fairly common last name. It's like Thomas, you know? So it's not uncommon in Italy, even though our families are kind of from the same area. So there's a chance we could be distantly related.
You should do one of those 23andMe tests where you can, like, you know, just get the DNA test done to see if there's any relation.
Yeah, And he did tell me, because he doesn't know too much about his family's history. He did tell me that he reached out to his grandma. And they did, she did, or when they came to America, they spelled their last name the same as my family spells it.
Okay.
Which I've never seen before. I've seen a couple with like two M's or two S's or things like that. His is IE. And he was saying that his grandma added the E in the hopes that it would help people pronounce it properly. Which I looked at him. I was like, how'd that work out for you? He's like, no.
Yeah. Didn't help. People are pretty god awful with names. So it's interesting because my wife's family is also Italian. They're from Sulmona, like the place where confetti originated, actually. And her last name is DeVito. And there's so many variations of DeVito, from Danny DeVito and the E and the I and different places. And part of the issue that there's the inconsistency I found is that at Ellis Islands, they would annotate people's names differently, right? Depending on which customs officer you got or intake officer you got.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's always interesting to me, just how immigrants' names carry over. But back to Travis Tomasi. So sometimes people aren't really the same in person as the way they present themselves in online or in media. But Travis is known, and I've met the guy too, shooting at Nationals. He is known for being a very genuine and earnest person. Is that what you experienced meeting him in person?
100%. I was kind of cautious going into it, because you know I always say like don't meet your heroes kind of thing, and I don't really get star-studded when I run into a famous person or anything like that, and I don't really care about famous people and celebrities, you know. But inside the shooting world, my wife asked me right before the class. She's like, if you could meet one person in the shooting world, who would it be? I was like, honestly, probably Travis, because he's had a pretty big impact in my shooting career, even though we hadn't met until this past December. So yeah, I was a little nervous. It's like, okay, one, this guy is busy. He's putting on a class for a bunch of students. I'm not the only one. I don't want to be an attention hog or, you know, take away from the other students who paid just like I did to be there. So trying to be fair on that sense. And what really kind of cued me into the personable guy that he is, there was another student there who is from the Georgia area when he was a kid, and the AMU used to host like youth events. And this kid brought, well, I say kid, he's probably, he was a Marine. He got out. He's probably in his mid-20s. Mm-hmm. And he brought a USPSA target that had a bunch of autographs on it. And he goes, hey, Travis, back, and he named the year, it was like 10 years ago. He's like, do you remember you guys did this youth event and you signed this target for me and a bunch of other people? And he like starts looking at it and he goes, oh yeah. Like, and he starts naming his teammates and their signatures. And he's like, yeah, no, I remember you. And in my head, I was like, dude, there's no way you remember this guy from an off chance, you know, an off meeting for a couple of days a decade ago. Like, how many people have you been exposed to since then? And so I was just thinking like, okay, he's just saying that to say it and kind of not appease the person, but just, you know, relate. And then he started asking the kid personal questions. He's like, yeah, because you were with so-and-so. And he starts recalling these very specific details about that one or two day event, you know, 10 years ago. So like, okay, like this guy truly does remember. And when he's talking to you, it's like you're the only person that's there, and he's very interested in what you have to say. And he took time to have personal conversations, not just about shooting, but about the students and their lives and their backgrounds and where they're going and things like that. So he has been portrayed as a nice guy because he is.
Mm-hmm.
It's real.
What you see is what you get. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that the Masterpiece Arms team, their jerseys on the back of the collar, it just says "Be like Travis." Both in terms of his technical proficiency with the pistol, but also just being a really good guy, and having shot with all the folks on the Masterpiece Arms team, then yeah, they all definitely embody that. Classes often require high round counts. I'm assuming this was a 2-day class. So the logistical planning is a little different from what you would normally go through attending a match. So how did you work the ammo and everything else you needed in preparation for this class?
Yeah, so luckily this wasn't too far away. I think I only had to drive about an hour to get there, but some of the other students flew. There were a couple who flew in. There was one from Alabama, another one from Georgia. It required about 800 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, I had 1,000 already loaded up, so I just brought the whole can. And the second day, some weather rolled in pretty aggressively, to where we had to, like, if there was a lull in the sky, you know, the heavens kind of break open, we run out from underneath the pop-up tent and shoot a little bit, and it starts dumping on us again, so we run back under the tent and do some class. So we didn't get to shoot as much on day two just because of the weather. But yeah, luckily I had enough ammo. Like I said, I found out a couple days before the class even took place, and I got to drive there. But they did say the range that it was at, Tony Cowden's place. Tony had ammo if people needed it or anything like that. Nobody ran out though, but it was fine.
Okay.
Not too challenging.
Yeah. How many people were in the class and what was the schedule like?
Yeah. I think there were 11 or 12 people. So it was really small. It was just at Tony's range, that first left bay, almost like a 270 bay.
Yep.
It was in there. We all fit in there comfortably. Let's see, there was a husband and wife and son, like a family, another father son duo, with one of their family friends, and then a couple of just individuals who took the class. And the skill level kind of ranged from experienced A class chase and master class type shooters to the husband, wife, and son trio. They're mostly three gunners.
Mm-hmm.
And they had actually never shot any USPSA type match. And this class was geared towards competition. So it's called this pistol performance class. It was fairly relaxed. He did have a structure to it, and he had wickets that he wanted to hit, and he stayed true to that. He would go over some, and I'm not going to repeat some of the things that he discussed just out of respect for the effort he put into that, to creating that class. But we'd do a class for about 45-50 minutes, and then we got in and prac app and shoot and you know, try the skill, then come back, do a little hot wash. What do we learn from that? Anyone, you know, discover anything that they want to expand on, and then just roll into another period of instruction. So we did that for 2 days, and it was a lot of shooting. It really was. Like your thumbs and fingers started to blister from stuffing mags so fast. And then let's see, day two. So it was a very progressive building block approach to each skill as it builds on the next and the last one. So it wasn't just kind of a spattering of, hey, let's talk about this skill over here, and then, oh, next we'll talk about that one. It was very much a building block approach to everything. And by the end of the class, you're stacking all of these skills together, and you're demonstrating and rehearsing and doing and executing all of these skills that you've just learned in the same stage. So that was really cool to see, And then what else?
If I could ask a quick question, I guess what were the building blocks? Because having taken a few classes, usually there's, you know, a little bit of movement, some transitions, grip, trigger manipulation. Was it that rudimentary, or did he blend it all together another way?
Yeah, it was a good question. It was blended very well. And you know, one thing you don't want to do is spend a bunch of money and you go to this class and the dude spends an hour and a half talking about gun safety and, you know, keep your finger straight off the trigger. It's like, okay, got it. Like, we are all, yes, I understand there has to be a safety structure in place and the instructor doesn't know the skill level of each person. So he has to assume a certain level of risk with that. Mm-hmm. But Travis, yes, we covered the safety part and there was no part of the class that was that anybody felt unsafe. It was very controlled. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we didn't talk about you know, when to click the safety off or shoot, he didn't even give us round counts for the drills. The assumption was come to the line with a bunch of mags, keep your gun up. And the drills weren't designed for you to run dry during specific portions. It was just, if you run dry, keep your gun fed and keep it up. And that was just, it was just assumed that you did that. But yeah, so it was, there was a building block. We did talk about grip and stance. And actually I since then have actually adopted Travis's stance. It's a little bit wider than normal than shoulder width, and his support foot or his dominant foot is a little bit further back and kind of flared out a little bit. And I tried that and I actually really like it. But so yeah, we did talk about grip and stance and eye focus, you know, target transitions. And the first half day, three quarters of the first day was all static, no movement, nothing. It was all just focusing on accuracy, learning how to shot call, how to apply or how to press the trigger on various level targets. And I'll admit, we've all heard, you know, slapping the trigger, like don't slap the trigger. And I was a big advocate of not slapping the trigger. And it maybe stems from my bullseye rifle years, of knowing when and how to apply your trigger. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel the need to slap my trigger, but I also get trigger freeze quite a bit. And what I learned in that is slapping the trigger on close open targets where you can get away with it protects you from getting trigger freeze. It's like, oh, like I, that was like the first kind of humbling experience. It's like, oh, like that's a very simple thing that you think you know. And then, you know, you discuss about it in the class for a little bit and you're like, oh, like that makes a heck of a lot of sense. So.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. Yeah. Last question for me, and then I'll turn it over to Matt. You said that the second day was a little more on the move. Did he set up a demo stage for you guys at all? Several classes I've been to have set up like a stage just to like practice on. Is that something you guys did?
We did. It did culminate in us shooting a stage, a designed stage. The first introduction to the movements and position entry and exits was just, you know, a square shooting box, a square shooting box, two targets and two targets, that kind of thing. And then we did some triangle drills where you're advancing from, you know, a triangle of cones and you're advancing and shooting laterally and then backwards or doing a square drill, things like that. But it did culminate in us shooting a stage. And one thing that another tool that I've since picked up from that is he calls them forced reps, where you shoot your stage and you shoot it at match speed. Like the goal is not to try and sandbag and kind of game the game, but shoot it at match speed and go through it. And then whatever your time was, take a half second off and go shoot it again. and that's your part time now. So if you shot it in 7.5 seconds, your new time to beat is 7 seconds or faster, obviously. And it forces you to push that envelope just a little bit. And I've been doing that a lot since then, and it's actually really, really helped.
So, awesome. So going back to, you know, class size and everything, as an instructor, you know, there's a diminishing return on how many students that you can have in a class where you can realistically devote a certain amount of time to the students. You know, and that's different for every person and how complex the training is. But, you know, given that, how much, you know, would you say that there was enough attention given to the students, and how do you feel about the less level of personal interaction that you had with Travis?
I think it was adequate. Absolutely. I didn't feel like I didn't get to ask the questions that I wanted, or that Travis wasn't giving equal attention to everybody. So having that, you know, 1:12 ratio, one instructor to 12 students, allowed the setting to be intimate enough where everybody got the attention that they are paying for in the class. And I think we took breaks frequently enough to where, any, like over lunch, we just, you know, sit on our gear, just eating lunch. Now we're just, you know, talking and learning about each other. And Travis was very good about driving those conversations and asking engaging questions, personal questions to people. And then we went to dinner after day one at, was it Mad Boar?
Yeah, Mad Boar. Yeah. That the random, like, so for those of you that are not familiar with the area, you're driving back. Is it 40? Is that the highway, or is it a different highway?
Yeah, 40 from Sir Walter.
Yeah. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this really, really nice freaking restaurant with like Tesla superchargers pops up out of nowhere. It makes zero sense why that is where it is. But yes, I remember that.
Yeah, it's like Irish pub, real cool inside.
Oh yeah.
And we all went to dinner, and got to catch up some more, and the camaraderie that Travis fostered in the class was outstanding. Got to meet, I didn't know a single person in the class. I'd known Tony, but he wasn't in the class. He just kind of popped in here and there. But I'd only known him because, you know, shot at his range. But since then, you meet everybody that's in the class, and you know, find them on social media, and we've just been kind of messaging back and forth. And, you know, that was what, 3 months ago, and we're still talking, and there's still, creative ideas flowing. And, the part about the class that I really, really enjoyed, and it's kind of what you experience at PME, in the Marine Corps is, you know, we all have the, what's it called? Policy of non-attribution, where you're allowed to challenge the norms. It's like, okay, why do we do it like this? Isn't there a better way? Why is maybe this way of thinking, or this what has been thought as taboo, like, why is that taboo?
I never did that just at PME. I would try and implement that, you know, at the teams as well. And some people liked it, some people didn't.
Yeah, I love challenging norms, because like the whole thing of like, well, that's how we've always done it.
Yeah,
exactly. So you're saying you're admitting to stagnating.
Mm-hmm.
You're admitting to being comfortable and complacent and not getting better. That doesn't sound good to me. So I love, you know, not being a disruptor, or someone who tries to stir the pot, but I like thinking about things in new ways. And well,
I think all high performing individuals are always trying to challenge the norm and always try and find a more efficient or better way to do something because it makes sense.
Right. Because what did Jack Weaver do when he developed the Weaver stance? Exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have since, I grew up on the Weaver stance and have since learned there are better stances. But you also need to be able to apply your skills to the same level of performance in any kind of situation where be you blading towards a target or away from the target or on the move or whatever. Like, you need to be able to apply those skills equally. Like a skateboarder or a snowboarder, they can ride going this way or they can ride going this way with equal level of skill. And in fact, you don't know, is he switch? Is he goofy? Like, I don't know. You know, is he regular? Nobody knows their stance because they are so comfortable applying it in any way. So, yeah.
So you kind of already alluded to like some things that you're working on, like specifically like your stance. You've changed that up and everything. But prior to going to the class, did you have this? Did you already have ideas of things that you wanted to work on, things that you needed to work on? And then whenever you got there, it kind of shifted to other aspects that you should be working on based on what was pointed out?
Yeah, absolutely. So I will be the first to admit I am not a good pistol shot. You can ask Cardenas. From him trying to coach me at championships in pistol bullseye a few years ago.
Well, we kind of had this conversation last week with Chris Serino, and whenever it comes to bullseye pistol, that's a sport of its own that I don't think really, you know, you're either good at it and you can pick it up naturally and do well, or you're not. Like, I'll be the first one to admit I kind of suck at it. You know, I think my average was about a 167 or 267, whatever it was out of the national match course of fire. Yeah. Which isn't horrible, but whenever you're looking at guys like from the shooting team that are averaging like a 92, you know, every single time, I think it was a 192 or 292, whatever the national match was, like they're damn near perfect. You're like, man, I suck compared to these guys. So I don't think you can really, you know, just because you're doing bullseye pistol, that's a style of shooting, and you know, it doesn't correlate with all the different styles.
Right. I agree. And I think I've broken triple digits in pistol bullseye once.
Mm-hmm.
I was stoked. but you know, I am not where I want to be with my pistol shooting in action or bullseye, which I'll be honest with you, I'm probably never going to touch bullseye pistol ever.
Thank you.
But
we have converted you.
Yes. I'm much more comfortable with rifle because that was where I grew up shooting. And I've logged hundreds of thousands of rounds shooting rifle. So I am much more naturally inclined to do well with rifle. I am not where I want to be with pistol. It is a big focus of my training right now. I'm not neglecting rifle, but I am prioritizing pistol. I'm a mid-range B-class USPSA shooter. You know, I'm not by any means going to be up there on the podium. So I went into this class knowing what I don't know, in the sense of I am open to any piece of advice. And I also need to recognize that when you try something new in your golf swing, it's probably not going to feel right. It's probably not going to look right. And you're not going to get the results that you want right off the bat, but you need to stick to it and keep trying it. And then if it still isn't working out, then yeah, you can change it. But so yeah, I did go into this class with some priorities of work, mainly on the accuracy side, applying the proper grip and trigger control, I think is my biggest deficiency in action shooting right now. I'm good with movement. I'm fast with movement and comfortable. I could still transition between targets and be a little bit more explosive or aggressive. That can always get better, but I think what would help me is the accuracy side of things. So I did go into this class with some goals of maybe not getting faster with my speed, but maintaining that speed while getting all alphas, or, you know, only throwing a, like, I don't go to matches anymore. And it's not uncommon for me to shoot a USPSA match and not have any mics and not have any no shoots, even though my nickname is no shoot. So I generally consistently am going to matches shooting mostly alphas and charlies and a handful of deltas. What I really want to do now is shoot almost all alphas, no deltas, and you know, sacrifice a couple charlies here and there when I need some speed. And that's kind of my training goal for that. And this class absolutely helped with that. And once I got to the class, I think another one of my strengths as a shooter, and having been exposed to Olympic coaches and getting to shoot at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs when I was in high school, is the mental management side of things, which was the first episode I did with you guys, talking about that and the how the sports psychology behind things in performance, and getting to talk with Travis about that was really fun. That was something that I learned new things about and new ways to look at stuff. But there aren't a whole lot of shooters out there who are into that side of the shooting and the reading a book to get better at shooting, like really. So I don't really get to talk about those kinds of things to a lot of other shooters out there. But having Travis to class, and he knows things, or he knows names like Lanny Basham, I almost said Richard Pryor, Raymond, Dr. Pryor from the Nebraska shooting team. He wrote a book called Bullseye Mindset, which for the Camp Lejeune shooting team, we got our shooting jerseys this weekend, and we had a little team dinner last night. And I passed out the jerseys, and I passed out with winning in mind from Lanny Basham, because I want these guys to start developing the mental management piece, not just for shooting, but also for life. Like those are life skills that I think transfer over very well. So,
on some of the stuff that you're picking up and seeing, and like, you know, are you finding yourself kind of getting in that zone and having that vision that you need, like, and by vision, you know, being able to see what you're doing, everything is kind of in that slow motion point of view, but you're actually performing faster than what you think you are?
Yes, absolutely. I've also been reading on achieving a flow state. And this class, I think, was a catalyst to unlocking a lot of skills and enhancing a lot of existing skills to now I am able to execute certain skill sets secondhand, like unconsciously, and focus and think about the things that I need to do as I'm executing the stage. So rather than thinking about my stage plan in that, okay, I'm going to go here and I need to engage these two targets in this order and then reload, I'm now thinking, okay, I'm a short person, and you know, sometimes those stages are just wrong in the step count, where you either need to do a couple extra steps or drive deeper into a position. So I'm now able to start thinking about, okay, drive deeper into this position and gun should already be up as I'm getting ready to engage this target as it becomes visible. And then I'm already thinking two shots ahead of I need to push hard and transition faster because this is a big transition. Like I'm starting to think about things beyond the simple stage execution. And I'm now thinking about what is it that I need to do, not to execute, but to execute faster or more accurate or whatever. So absolutely.
Got a quick follow-up. Parker, you mentioned Lanny Basham, and that book is really great if you're getting into competitions. Have you looked into Steve Anderson's material at all? He's known as the dry fire guy, but he's also a mental management coach.
I have not.
So okay. Steve does a podcast. He is a Lanny Basham, I don't know what you'd call him, a Padawan.
Student ambassador. Yeah.
He is basically like license to go and teach that class.
Okay.
But he's also a coach for a decent amount of guys on the Masterpiece Arms team. He's mentioned, I don't think he explicitly coaches Travis, but okay. he has been there when Travis has been shooting and they have talked about the mental game. But okay. specifically, he's a coach for Joey Sauerland and Greg Clement. Both of those guys are on the Masterpiece Arms team. I actually did a Zoom call with him after IPSC Nationals, and we just kind of went through the things I was seeing and how I was feeling and the way the match, he went through my my match results, asked me about how I was feeling and what my preparation was for each stage. And that was massively helpful. So
okay.
it's great that your guys all have the Lanny Basham book. I have it too. But eventually, I think Steve Anderson is a good person to turn them on to as well.
Okay. Yeah, and with winning in mind, is it's geared towards, you know, Olympic three position or international air rifle.
Yeah, I found it applicable though.
But yeah,
like,
it's
I never did. I feel like he was talking about something that I was like, oh, I'm never going to use that. Yeah.
Right. Okay, Steve Anderson. I will look that up. I like that. Okay.
Just another thing. Like, I know you are going out, and your guys, you have a shooting team, and your guys are going out and shooting USPSA and everything. And I don't know what your thoughts on are doing, taking them out to two gun matches, but I know the Paris Island shooting team has been going up to Carolina Guns and Gear, Zoo City, two gun matches. Like, they shot one a couple weekends ago. Maybe doing some coordination with like Archbell and meeting up with those guys there and kind of having like a whole Marine Corps squad. That'd be pretty good. That way you can kind of like two weapons training battalions in the, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, getting together, going and shooting a match together.
Absolutely. That'd be really good. A lot of the guys, I mean, it's caught on like wildfire. I'm not saying that I did that. But it's an addictive sport, obviously. And these guys that are on the Camp Lejeune installation shooting team, they're all about it. They're on fire for it. It's been so much fun watching them grow and improve. And there's this hunger and desire to better themselves, and that's been really fun to watch. So yeah, we do two gun matches. PCSL, I'm really stoked about. So I think that's going to be a really big sport here very shortly. I mean, shoot, it already is. But yeah, that'd be fun to link back up with Arch and go shoot with him too.
Yeah. Kind of shifting gears completely. You are about to embark on a pretty new journey here soon. You know, I just did it, you know, over a year ago in retiring. And shoot, that wasn't even the first time I got out. I got out once before in 2006 and then, you know, came back like 5-6 months later, just because I wasn't done. But you're about to get out. You have over 10 years of service, and that's not the traditional approach. Most of the time people are like, hey, if you have 10 years in, just stick it out, suck it up, you know, finish your time in. But you're taking more of an untraditional route, whether it's to accomplish life goals and whatnot. But how did you come to that decision? And what do you say to others that are contemplating their futures as well?
Yeah. So just to explicitly state what Matt's getting at is, yeah, I've decided to get out of the Marine Corps, after, I guess, 13 years. I love the Marine Corps. I've really enjoyed the experiences that I've gotten to do here, and mainly the people that I've gotten to serve with and the friendships and relationships. Yeah, so I'm going to get out this year. And don't quite know exactly what I will be doing. I have a business venture that I'm trying to start, but we can talk about that later if you want, which is also very exciting.
Let's talk about it whenever it's all up and running and there's a plan in place.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's moving forward too. Good. Like it's still on track. But yeah, the decision to get out was not easy. And I mean, we've all had those days. I call them EAS days and re-enlist days. Like today was a re-enlist day, and tomorrow might be an EAS day where you're just like, I need to get the heck out of here. So it wasn't a decision that I made quickly or lightly. Mostly my reasons for getting out are to be more there for my kids. That's more a personal side of it's not like I'm disgruntled with the Marine Corps and like want to leave this broken organization that, or what, you know, that's not it. It's more of a desire to, be there for my kids. My dad just retired this year and I'm really close with my dad. So, getting to go back home, raise my kids, to be around my parents and have a relationship with their grandparents. I really want that for them. I am going to do the reserves. So I can still, you know, get my Marine in one weekend a month. So I'll still stay in the organization that way. But, yeah, it's hard because especially at 13 years in, you're like, oh, okay, like I got 7 more to go. Like that's what, 2 PCSs? Like I can do two more units. But people get married to the benefits and to the retirement, which is true. It's comfortable. I know Matt, you're enjoying your retirement and it's, you know, hard earned and well deserved. But my reasoning for joining the Marine Corps was not to have a career. My reasoning was to serve my country. I still want to serve it, but in a different capacity now. I think, I don't know. It's hard. It's something. It's a decision that I'm still coming to terms with. And there are going to be days that I'm really going to miss it. And even though I've made the decision and I have my commission resignation has been accepted, it's still hard for sure. Mainly, and especially like things like last night, having a team dinner with the shooting team guys for the base team, just a bunch of great people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not really wanting to say goodbye to that, but I'll start it in my own way.
You know, the other part of the question, what do you tell people who are contemplating getting out and based off of what you're going through now?
That's hard because we're all disgruntled in some way. We're all belligerent in some way. And that's one thing that I've kind of had to check myself on is, you know, I'm a field grade officer. And if I start listing the reasons why I'm getting out, that can influence other people. And, you know, young Lance Corporals who may not have the right frame of mind to be able to think things or understand why there's friction in certain areas. So that's been a very challenging thing that I have had to learn how to navigate is when there is somebody who's like, man, I think I'm just going to get out. Like, what do you think? It's like, well, it's a very personal thing. Like we all have our own reasons for serving. I think my only advice to someone who's contemplating staying in or getting out is your motivation should not be the money. And I know young Marines don't make a lot of money, mm-hmm. But that shouldn't be your motivation for staying in. It shouldn't be like, well, if I stay in and get 100% disability or all these other benefits that come with multiple deployments and certain awards come with benefits. Yeah, but that shouldn't be why you do it. Like really at the end of the day, we all take an oath. So reread that oath and ask yourself, can I still uphold that oath? And if you can, then cool, stay in. But if your reasons for staying in are the money, It's comfortable. It's reliable. It's, yeah, you know, it's I'm not going to say it's the easy road, because it's, there's nothing about this job that's easy. But that shouldn't be why you do it. It should be to serve your country. The willingness to sacrifice is part of it, but yeah, it's challenging when people ask you, should I stay in, should I get out?
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I have conversations like that. I mean, I'm still working on a Marine Corps base, and you know, people ask me, and I mean, I tell people, you gotta, they essentially have to figure out what it is that they want in life, what they want out of the Marine Corps, and what they want to do for the Marine Corps. And they, if they're going to get out, they need to have that plan. They have to at some point become selfish to have a plan, or come up with a plan that's going to allow them to take care of themselves and their family. But you know, you have to know your reason why, and if you're truly ready or not. I mean, one of the reasons that kept me going is, you know, I've had a string of very good leaders. I've had a string of very bad leaders. I wanted to be one of those good leaders that the guys can look up to, and I can make a positive impact on their lives, and not be their friend, but be their leader and carry them through success and make them better citizens to this country. And that was very much one of the reasons that, and I just love deploying. What other job can you have to where you can travel and do things that are, one, going to protect this country, whether it's in a tactical manner or in a strategic manner, and just influence the lives of other people? There's not many roles out there. And even being out, you have to find those ways. Like, if you're built like we are, you have to find those ways to where you can still make an impact on people's lives. Because it's true, when you get out, there are times where you really feel like there's no purpose. And you have to find that purpose whenever you're out.
Yeah, I think that's the part that I'm going to struggle with if I don't find a purpose. But so this my dry fire room in here, but I have those whiteboard adhesive things that you can like tape to your wall, and I'm trying to start my purpose with my two closest friends outside of the Marine Corps. Well, they were Marines as well, but there is a shooting range in New Mexico that is currently for sale that we are trying to acquire. It's a big range too. Like, it's capable of hosting national level events. So if we're able to do this and secure funding, put in an offer, a tasty enough offer for them to bite off on. Yeah, this is the little room where I am starting that little business. So, hopefully that'll help augment the, I'm not going to say loss of purpose when you get out of the Marine Corps, but it should be a shifting of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see, more to follow on that. Hopefully we can do a podcast in the ranch house of that range during a national match.
That'd be super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Frank, you had something?
No, I covered everything. But okay. Parker, did you want to talk a little bit about the event Stone Bay has coming up?
Yeah, so it is Mi'kmaq season. Obviously, I think NCR, Far East have all happened. I think Pacific just wrapped up, or they're shooting
just
right now.
They just got back from Pacific.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So Mi'kmaq East. So for any Marine who is in the Eastern region, who wants to try their hand at shooting and shooting competitions, Mi'kmaq East will be 8 March through 15 March this year on Stone Bay. It will be a Friday to Friday schedule, which we are shooting through the weekend. So it's only 7 to 8 days, but ARQ and CPP are taken out of the POI. So it's a bit shorter, And the sole focus of this year is just going to be skill building and competition. So we're really excited for that. The Marines at Stone Bay have been putting in a lot of work during like on and off work hours. We shoot all day, all week, and then on weekends we go shoot some more at matches. So it's kind of nonstop, which is great. So really excited for Mi'kmaq this year. The registration is open on Practice Score. If you just go to matches and type in FY24, you'll see Mi'kmaq East. Night match again this year. I think we're going to – I know last year we had to turn away some people just because there's only so much daylight for us to shoot in. And, you know, the driving factor there is how many live fire ranges can we run concurrently. Like, that's our throughput limitation. So it's going to be about the same this year. We'll have about 175 slots open and registration is live. So go sign up. And it doesn't have to be I know a lot of Marines are like, well, I'm not that good of a shot, or I've never shot in a competition before, so I can't go to Mi'kmaq.
Just show up.
Dude, just show up. Yeah, it like Mi'kmaq is a perfect atmosphere to get introduced to competitive shooting.
And you're never going to know how good you actually are, or how bad you actually are, unless you go shoot. And then, I mean, it's a great way to figure out where your flaws are in order to start working on them for the future.
Yeah. It's I was dead last in my first competition. Dead last.
Me too.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's the guys out there who say like action shooting isn't combat and it induces training scars. Okay. I see your point, but I will counter that with, yes, competition is not combat, but combat is a competition.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want the first time you're in competition for your life to be in combat, or do you want to be able to like know how to think through problems in a stressful environment?
Well, I mean, I keep saying this over and over, and it's like, I wish I had the knowledge and the skills that I have now back in 2005 when I first went to my very first competition in the desert and was put to the test. Was I successful? I mean, I survived, but we could have came back. You know, I think if we had a unit of competitive shooters, I mean, it's never going to happen realistically, but if we had a unit full of seasoned, you know, gunfighters going out there, we would have had less casualties and we would have killed a whole lot more enemy. And I mean, it would have been beautiful, but that is the beautiful thing of the evolution of marksmanship. Like, the Marine Corps is actively looking to improve marksmanship, you know, to make Marines more lethal.
And guess what? The Commandant just did. I think this isn't going to be 100% accurate, but I think this is the first time this has happened in over 50 years. He just meritoriously promoted somebody based off of their excellence in marksmanship.
Oh, wow.
At intramurals this past year at East, we had our high grand aggregate was a Lance Corporal from 1-8, Lance Corporal Doug Koenig. He was second in rifle and second in pistol, first overall. Young Lance Corporal, right?
Any relation to the Doug Koenig, you know, competitor?
I don't think so. And I say young Lance Corporal. He joined a little bit later in life, so he's a bit older than most of his peers. But the current CO of 1-8, Lieutenant Colonel Kerrigan, who's got a bit of a social media presence.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the award ceremony, and he, you know, posted pictures of his young Lance Corporal on the number one spot, and he posted on social media, and General Smith saw that. It's like, that's pretty cool. He's a corporal now. The Commandant saw that and was like, that is exactly the type of thing that I want to reinforce inside our ranks. And he meritoriously promoted Corporal Koenig. And now he's on the base shooting team.
Oh, hell yeah.
So
I know we're going to want to bringing you back on after McMick East. I think that'll be a really good conversation. But we do appreciate you coming on here and talk to us, not just about, you know, your class with Travis Tomasi, but, you know, the mental process of getting out and finding purpose and you know, talking to us about the Marine Corps Marksmanship Competition coming up. But other than that, that's all we really have to our listeners. We hope you really enjoyed this. Please let us know how we're doing. Please give us a follow, like, comment, reach out to us. And if you have any questions for Major Parker Tomasi, please reach out and we can get any information that you would like to, any questions you may have to him. Please just reach out and we'll get it to him so he can answer you. Other than that, have a great one, and we'll talk to you at the next one.
Are you still recording?
Yes.
So if anybody has questions about McMick East, just hit me up on social media, Tomasi_shooting. And it's not spelled like Travis's. It's Tomasi. No E.
Awesome. Now Travis Tomasi is going to get a bunch of messages about the make, and he's like, I don't know. But yeah, guys, we hope you enjoy this, and we'll talk to you later.
Sweet.